Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Wake Up to Purpose with your host, John Stanko. This program will help you find your purpose and, more importantly, how to make your purpose work for you. And now, here's John Stanko.
Hello out there in internet land. This is the man he told you was coming, John Stanko, your host for Wake Up to Purpose. And if you're listening live, I hope you had a very good weekend. I know we did, although all the weekends have been just about the same the last 3 months, and it's been an interesting pattern and routine, but certainly not complaining. But if you're not listening on a weekend, I hope you are doing well whenever you happen to be listening, whatever day of the week it is. Today we have my friend someone who's been on the show before, Sheldon Williams, was on a month ago. Talking to us about current events from his perspective as a pastor and a former law enforcement officer. And so I thought it would be good to bring Sheldon back on to get sort of his sense of where things are at. He continues to process the events of the day and the responses of people to those events. And three of the shows that I have recorded since I started blog radio up someplace right around the beginning of the pandemic, three of those shows have gone, they've been very popular shows. One was Irene Marathi from Kenya, where she gave us kind of her purpose update on the latest that was going on with her. Another one was Felicia Lynch from Barbados. We were talking about her book, The Invisible Leader, but we talked about a whole lot more than that. And the third show was the one we did with Pastor Sheldon, who I'll be bringing on in a few minutes, that was back on June the 1st. And so all of those are accessible in the archives, and they are there forever. And so you can listen to them anytime, as often as you want. And with Sheldon, he always has good things to say. So I'm looking forward to an update, as I always say, and brief you, the listener, that I do not prepare any of my discussions with guests. I don't send any questions, and because I have a relationship with most of them, they don't ask for any, because they know we're just going to be talking as friends, as colleagues, as brothers and sisters, and so we're just going to let other people listen in while we do. So please don't go anywhere so we can hear everything that Pastor Sheldon has to say. I was just talking on Facebook Live last night. I had a creativity class online where it's a Zoom call, and there I am with 10 students who are reading my book, Unlocking the Power of Your Creativity, and talking about how it is impacting them, and they're sharing their creativity, the things they make, the things they write, the rhymes they create, the pictures they paint or draw, and it is so special. It is such an honor to have a front row seat to be able to hear the feedback from what I have written. I wish every author had that privilege to take advantage of. And they've gone; these classes have gone so well. We just finished 4 of 6 weeks last night. That when they're done mid-July, I'm going to take a week off, and then I'm going to start some online purpose classes. And there will be a fee for these. And the reason I feel like I have to do that is, some people are making their livelihood from coaching and teaching and training on purpose, and I don't want to come along and undercut what they're doing. So I right now was planning on having 2 classes, but the response has been so big, I may have to have more. I was going to have one Saturday morning, one Wednesday evening. I'm thinking about adding one like at noontime on Sunday. And the reason I would do that is it's 5 p.m. in England, 6 p.m. in South Africa, and 7 p.m. in Kenya. And much of my interest is from outside the country. So I am raising money for scholarships. for those who would like to enroll, but and I probably have a list of 7 or 8 people who have applied, one from the U.S., the rest from Nigeria and South Africa and Kenya. And so, but I don't feel bad charging because so much of what I have is available out if people search for it. If you download the Purpose Quest International free mobile app, there's about 15 hours of high-quality video teaching and training that I've done on all kinds of topics, preached messages or seminars, and so Purpose is there. It's on my website. I write every week the Monday memo. I blog every week. I've got purposequest.com is my website. So if somebody really wants to dig into my material on purpose, they can find it. And so this is going to be a little different, but it's if it goes the way the creativity classes have gone, I can't wait. I just can't wait to engage people at that level, and I believe Irene Marathi is going to be in one of the classes with me. Well, that's doesn't get any better than that. If you're in that class, you have two people who have given a lot of their adult lives and the years thereof to the study and application of the purpose message. So anyway, you can write me, drop me a line at johnstanko@gmail.com if you are interested, and that's also the way you apply for the scholarships, and they will be given not on a first-come, first-serve, but on I hope I have enough to let everybody in, but if not, I'll be looking at background and why somebody wants to take the class, what it will do for them. Now, before we bring Sheldon on, let's continue with our tradition of reading a psalm. We are today in Psalm 114, and this is in Book 5 of the 5 books that are found in the Psalms. And as I have explained before, each one of these books has a particular theme. And the way the Psalms and the way those 5 books are put together, there is also a message. And this is all clearly spelled out in my fable fiction book, My Enemies, My Friends, where I have a pastor going through a church crisis while he is in a class on Psalms. And so I include my teaching on Psalms in light of what I just shared with you about the 5 books and the order of the Psalms. And so My Enemies, My Friends is something that if you are sheltering in place, you may want to get a copy and read it. Psalm 114, however, says, "When Israel came out of Egypt, Jacob from a people of foreign tongue, Judah became God's sanctuary, Israel his dominion. The sea looked and fled, the Jordan turned back, the mountains leaped like rams, the hills like lambs. Why was it, sea, that you fled? Why, Jordan, did you turn back? Why, mountains, did you leap like rams, you hills like lambs? Tremble, earth, at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of the God of Jacob, who turned the rock into a pool, the hard rock into springs of water." Now we read that, and it's a great message, and it's special. But if you understand the context of why it was put in the 5th book of the 150 Psalms, you now have a whole different perspective, because that 5th book, keeping in mind that the Psalms were assembled, not written, but assembled and ordered, probably in the Babylonian captivity, when Israel was getting ready to come back to their land, they were getting back in touch with their roots, not the temple, not the king, but the God of the universe who had brought them out of Egypt. And so they were seeing a parallel between their exodus out of Babylon and the first exodus out of Egypt, reminding themselves of who they were as the people of God as they were to return to their homeland. It wasn't about a building. It was about the presence of God in their history. Anyway, buy the book. Learn something. In the meantime, it's time to bring on my guest, Sheldon Williams. Welcome back to Wake Up to Purpose.
Dr. John, how are you? Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. And so what have you been doing the last month? What you been up to?
Some of what I'm doing right now. lots of opportunities to talk and to discuss these matters. It's opportunity to talk about injustice, talk about police-community relations, to talk about the church's response. Is there things that the church could be doing? And just a lot of opportunities for discussion. And I welcome those opportunities because as long as people are engaged and being intentional about hearing, but after hearing about it, wanting to do the next step is to say, is there something we can do to support change or be part of change? I'm glad to be part of that process. So it's been busy, and I'm not disappointed at all. I think the timing is right for opportunities like this, and for as much as the Lord will lay at my feet to make it available, I plan to participate. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How's your family been doing in this time? Emerging, still hunkering down, cautious? What's the year approach been to this reemerging from the sheltering in place during the pandemic?
Sure. And, you know, it's difficult. We're still trying to balance and try to understand what safety means, and we're trying to follow that faithfully. And so, you know, my family is struggling with kids and the like, you know, with things shut down at one point. So we participate and help along with them, but also, you know, we have our restaurant we run. And so maintaining social distancing and all of the requirements, masks and the like for customers who come in, it's a little challenging and people get a little upset. But we got to follow the rules and try to be as polite as possible, but I have to adhere to them, and they're about to be a little more stringent here now that our own particular area is going back a little bit because of the recent uptick of positive tests. So the virus is here. It doesn't discriminate. Doesn't know political party. Doesn't know ethnicity. It just is there. So
it's an equal opportunity destroyer. Yeah,
it is. It is. So we have to contend with that as well while we contend with these other matters at hand.
Yeah. Now, you are pastoring a church. It's a church plant out of our church, Allegheny Center Alliance. Talk to us about Fellowship 412, what it was like before the pandemic, what it's been like during, and what you're looking to do with the church as we emerge.
Sure. So, you know, one of the the big things for me, I mean, one of the priorities for me is first to make a group of individuals feel like they are a church family, and we've accomplished that. I have a very strong core group of individuals, some transplants from ACAC, some who came from the area and really started embracing what we represent with ACAC's DNA over in the Homestead area, known as Fellowship 412. And so we had great momentum. I was very pleased about not only the people coming together, sense of family and fellowship, but also their hearts and their desire to be intentional for the community that we were desiring to serve and to minister with. And I say with because we don't want to minister to or for. We want to be with the people. So we were really, really moving along with that. And we were collaborating with different ministry opportunities in the area. We were launching our own. People were being attracted to checking us out at Fellowship 412. We still had, you know, back when we were in the theater before we went to our church building in mid-April of 2019, we started 2018 in this movie theater, and then almost 1 year to the day almost, we moved to a church building. But when we were in the theater, we only had about 2 weeks out of that almost 52, 53, 54 weeks, whatever it was. Only 2 weeks where we didn't have at least one brand new visitor, at least one person who had never been there before and had never been to ACAC. You know, we had at least one every week. Some weeks we had more handfuls or whatever. Now, how they return and if they return, that's for a later question. I say that because we moved over to the church building. We saw not exactly every single week, but we still were attracting people very frequently. We're just checking this out. I heard about the church plant, you know, come to check you out. And it was very rewarding to see that people were interested in the church that we were planting. I give you all that because I was really feeling good about, I was discipling some, implemented some leaders, discipling some others. We had all our groups had started. We had ministries going on, men's ministry, women's ministry. We were designing what we wanted to do with the kids, and that's where we got to some of those collaborative efforts with other youth groups in the area where they allowed us to align with them, and some of our people were volunteering and just, why should we have to recreate anything when they're doing it well and serving well? All that, and then here comes COVID and shuts our church down. Now that, and I say shut it down because now we can't connect. We can't do the stuff we would normally do. And that really made me really go to prayer, and it was a strong prayer point, continues to be, because I don't want to lose that momentum, the excitement behind people wanting to be part of fellowship for one, two. And so I still do things, you know, it's not like we don't connect. I mean, through Zoom, I meet with the church every single week in a Zoom meeting, inviting everyone to that Zoom meeting, and either we share, we do breakout rooms so people can connect. I'll give words of encouragement or whatever so that there's still contact there. But it's not the same. And when you have a church that just started, I don't want big bumps in the roads or hiccups that could slow or stop our momentum. So that's just been a prayer point.
Yeah. Now, I'm almost embarrassed to say that we ended the last show talking about your restaurant. And I don't think I ever connected the fact that the restaurant is in your community where the church is. And so talk to us a little bit about the restaurant and part of your philosophy of opening there, because, you know, somebody may be thinking, you know, here's a pastor and, you know, and he's very, you know, now very socially involved, but he also has a restaurant. Why that? I thought it was just a great description of the reason. So tell us again.
Sure. So, you know, whenever Faye and I live over in the Homestead area, we live in an area, the city's part of Homestead. We live in New Homestead. There's New Homestead, West Homestead, and Homestead, and they're all co-located, very close. You can't tell the distinction on the boundary lines because they just kind of blend together. But you know where you pay your taxes. That's kind of how you know what part you're in. So, but we were here for about 10 years. We're coming up on 10 years now. And we moved from the west side. We lived there a long time, over 20 years in the west side. All of our kids still live over there. And we moved over to this part of town. And we shop. I work out in the waterfront. I shop down in the waterfront. And just getting to learn at Homestead and the area. I mean, we went to the Carnegie Library, which is right up the street from where the church is current. We spent our time in this area. And so whenever the idea for the satellite church plant or church campus, there were three components that had to come together. You know, we had to have the right model. What was the model we were going to plant? Was it going to be a daughter church? Was it going to be a satellite? Was it going to be a missional community? The right place, you know, we could have went west. We could have went east, you know, we're kind of southeast. So we could have went around the city anywhere, so the right place, and then the right person. All three of those had to come together. It was not, well, Sheldon lives in the Homestead area. Let's do a satellite church and put it over there. That's not how that came together. It was all through fasting and prayer, and all three of those were braided together, and that's how we got there. So when we decided we live there, we're going to be worshiping there, Faye and I made a personal decision and said, look, let's invest our money in this community. Let's show that not only are we a part, we want to minister here, let's put our personal dollars into this ministry. And so that's what we did. We took our savings and parts of our retirements and stuff, and we put all that together, and we always wanted to own a franchise. We sought some other franchise opportunities, but either we didn't have the liquidity or, you know, there was too much. It was too much red tape to get through. And we had a longstanding relationship and friendship with the people from Hulk Fish and Chicken. They have been my friends for over 20-something years or whatever. I met them when I was first patrolling the streets, and they had planted their first one over in the in the Homewood area, right on Washington Boulevard, and we became friends. They're all family owned, and never allowed any investors, never allowed any franchising, licensing, or investors. They want to keep it family owned. And just through my friendship with them, they told me no multiple times, and then I kept working at it. And finally, they provided us an opportunity to be part of and to own a license of Hook Fish and Chicken. So we own that restaurant. We own, of course, there are terms to it, like that we get renegotiated. So we can be Hook Fish and Chicken under a license term for 15 years and to be renegotiated after that 15 years. But we planted there and wanted our monies to be there. First hires were from the neighborhood. We specifically, other than my son, who's the operating manager, who has, he's a firefighter now, still in the military, but he also had restaurant experience. Used to assistant manage Eden Parks, and so he kind of had restaurant experience. We made him the operating manager. Other than him, he was actually, if you want to say technically, the first hire. Our first employees were from the neighborhood. At least four of them were from the neighborhood. We were intentional about that. We wanted to make sure we trained them up right from the neighborhood and to show. So the whole reason behind it was community. Dr. John, it's about, you know, if we're really going to be there and be intentional about us saying we are this community, then I wanted to put and make sure that we had ticks in all the boxes. We worship there. We live there. We invest here. Mm-hmm. We spend our time here. And so I didn't want them feeling, when you're trying to minister to people and with people, to feel like I'm a transient, like, you know, I don't have a sense of belonging or ownership. Then we have stake in the community. And finally, I'll say dividing line in Homestead. Homestead has millions of dollars of commerce that happens down in that waterfront. And for many years, most of that money, I'm going to say all of it, I don't know where it goes, but it wasn't translating up the hill into the Homestead community. That money was going other places. And so it's always been a question from the people around here. They'll talk about the boogeymans of the community that they talk about, well, where's this money? I mean, because it's a popular place down there for shopping, for eating, and for recreation. You know, there's a lot to do down there. We decided to not even pursue a spot in the waterfront. We wanted to make sure we were on the Homestead side to make sure that our tax dollars we're generating would benefit the community. And so I think it's been a blessing. It's part, you know, there's multiple chapters to this story that all surround the community, because our partnership or our relationship with the Hook Fish and Chicken individuals who own that, that we don't believe the same, but we're about community. You know, we're Christian and they aren't. We don't believe the same, but we believe in community. And we have friendships, even though of our challenges. And I always say it's also a ripe opportunity for me always to share Jesus anyway. I will readily admit, some people might chastise me for this, but I was not the walk around the neighborhood, knock on your door type of guy. That's not how I'm not going up, knocking on doors, trying to stop at people's houses. I try to provide opportunities to draw people so we can make introduction, make yourself available. I look for casual opportunities to be engaged with people. But I say that because the restaurant has been a wonderful platform. I've had so many conversations just sitting down before COVID, sitting down in the dining room of the restaurant. People cycle through. Some may know I'm an owner after a while. Many don't. And we're just sitting there, and we'll strike up conversation. I get to learn about the lives of individuals, where they come from, if they gather. And it just furthers conversations, and it's just nice, casual, and it has provided a good platform and a front door for engagement with people in the community. So it's been a blessing. Thankful for it. And right now, you know, we're doing okay. Lots of support. And I appreciate the community continuing to support us. And it's important. So,
before we move on, tell the address where it is, so if our listeners want to come by, they know where to go.
605-607 Amity Street. It's right across from the Aldi supermarket as you're going into the waterfront.
Yeah, right before the railroad tracks. Or right
before
after the railroad tracks, if you're coming out of the waterfront.
If you took the waterfront, correct.
Yep. So, we always come the other way. So it's before. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Sheldon Williams, a restaurant owner, pastor, and former law enforcement officer who has stayed very close to that field. And now, of course, law enforcement is front and center in our society's discussion, and it is under the microscope, perhaps like never before. Sheldon, it's been 4 weeks since we talked, and you said you've done interviews, and I thank you for always letting me know when you're going to be on something. I can't always listen, but I do like to know and keep listen when I can. You know, how has your message sharpened or focused, or how has it stayed the same over the last 4 weeks? You mentioned social justice and police community relations and the church's response. Just dive in on sharing any of that with us. What's the most common things you're talking about, or what seems to emerge? What have you really focused in on that you're able to say with clarity and conviction that seems to be making an impact on people?
Well, first, I want to mention that I'm glad that the discussion and the topic hasn't died as a result of George Floyd. You said we're 4 weeks past that time frame, and yet people are still engaged. People are still continuing conversations, trying to do the next step towards action. And I'm glad for that, because I didn't want it to be another incident that would just subside and then we wait for the next incident to happen. So that there are some issues that need to be addressed, and I will quickly want to comment that not every situation is a George Floyd. That situation, I'm not saying that they don't happen, but we won't categorize every single police and citizen encounter to be equal with the George Floyd. But there is a way that policing is done in some communities that if we take a hard look at some of them, that we see something that's very similar across the country. And I'll say in American policing, you can go to any particular state and go to a particular community in that state and see there are similar complaints about the interactions between law enforcement and those citizens of those respective communities. Now, some of them happen to be communities of color, but also that there are communities that some people would describe differently, whether they're lower socioeconomic and the like. So, I mean, there are variable things that play in here, but I do want to speak to some specificity. That there are different communities that view their police officers, the relationships with those police officers, and view their police officers differently. And people should not assume that everybody views the people who are called to protect and serve as the same. There might be a desire, or there could be an apathy too, but there could be a desire for people. Maybe, you know, they have a very optimistic view, but then there's something that's challenging them, whether it's their own personal experiences, whether it's the ones that they witness just by being bystanders, or the stories that they've heard. Now, some of them credible, some of them not. And all I'm saying is there are different lenses that people view those police encounters. And those are where the stories are generated that is touching on the sensitivities of people. When we see this, when you see a George Floyd, sometimes inaccurately could be lumped into here we go again. But there is an element that says, oh, no, here we have another situation where a person of color is being treated unfairly at the hands of one of our law enforcement. Well, right now we have probably the most, I've seen widespread agreement around George Floyd, and there's others being brought forward, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and now people are talking about Elijah McClain, and that incident was over a year ago. Like, what's happening with how some law enforcement officers are interacting with some people in our community? And it brings me to this. This is the thing that I've been speaking about more, and I believe there's some credibility to this. And I'm hoping that we can help redirect by having discussions related to this, that I've presented that we always expect our law enforcement officers, they're law enforcement officers, it's male and female, our law enforcement entrusted officers. Because sometimes I hear policemen that said, I'm talking about all of them, law enforcement officers, that we want them to all to be assertive. There's nothing inflammatory or wrong about a police officer being assertive. Assertive police officers are confident in their capability. They should be confident about their view of the law and the execution of the law. We don't want timid, afraid, scared officers, inexperienced, don't know which way to. We want them to be confident that they know the law, know how to apply the law, and that they can do so and effectuate those duties as they're supposed to. What we see is two other A words that come up. We see assaultive police officers and aggressive police officers. Now, on those ends, that we there is times that police officers have to act aggressively, and that sometimes the use of force is that's an aggressive action. If you have to use force to either facilitate an arrest or to minimize a threat, there are ways to go about that. But what we don't want is in behavior, attitude, that somebody automatically has an aggressive perspective and or aggressive pursuit in how they're going to have conduct. And we see this. If police officers, this isn't the officer with a bad day. You know, everybody has days that aren't as good as other days. I mean, I'm not talking about those. And I don't even want to categorize those. We expect officers to operate based on their perceptions, based off of where they stand on the law, to do what they're supposed to do. Bad days, we don't want any of them. So I'm not speaking of that. I'm talking about a course of conduct that when you go to certain neighborhoods already, there is this aspect that I'm going to operate in this mode, like a switch goes on. And some of that comes from three buckets, Dr. John, that I think. I think it comes from one of three buckets that you can end up having officers operating aggressively and then also moving over to assaultive type behaviors. Is one of three buckets. Either they operate out of fear when it's communities that don't look like them or communities that are lumped together, whether it's that's a crime-ridden neighborhood, that's a poor community. When you start making these categories, and do you pursue it in a certain way? And one of three buckets, I think it's out of fear, out of ignorance. There is some prejudice, bias, bigoted type of behavior that could be underneath there. And all three of those different. You can have biases that are somewhat the starting point or whatever, and not be bigoted or racist. And, you know, I always say every one of us has, I got to believe we all have biases. And we need, because we're all flawed. So we all need to work on our own biases. But so when individuals have that and there's a bias related to color or culture or individuals, then there's one of those three buckets. So it's out of fear, out of ignorance, or out of some bias, bigoted, or racist motive underneath. Well, that will cause, that's already, you're perceiving, you're already walking down a pathway, and that's where we can have those aggressive and then at times assaultive type of interactions come out. So I'm making distinction. When we talk about threats, and you've heard me speak on them, and I will always look at when these things happen, when there's a use of force, when there's a complaint of excessive force or some maltreatment or mistreatment on parts of police officers, because they're different. There's mistreatment and maltreatment. But if there's something that happens, let's listen to the facts. And what's happening now is that you just don't have a one-part story. Society at large gives a lot of support to our police officers, a lot of support. They want to believe that they have high moral fiber, that ethically they operate, and by and large, they do, but by and large, most of them do, but the human. And so, you know, there are some individuals, and this is where we work through. It's not that I'm going to come against the culture that accepts that type of aggressive, and then sometimes when it delves over into assault, I want to counteract that we don't go into crime-ridden neighborhoods, even if there are high incidents of shootings and high incidents of drug trafficking. Even with that, there are crimes that are occurring, and we want to make sure that our law enforcement officers are addressing those crimes. But that can't be, you know, the greater good. Oh, we get all these guns off the street, or we're stopping all the drug trafficking, and then treat the people who are living there, treating them poorly just because you think you're doing the best service for them. No, we need you to respond appropriately, and then this way, by and large, you have far more individuals, way more than we see excessive force or an excessive use of force claims. By and large, the number one complaint against law enforcement officers across the country is that of discourtesy, standing firmly on the law and just how you treat somebody, you know, and the interaction with somebody, and then that's triggering some individuals, and then they walk away from that experience like, you know, feeling poorly about the exchange because of the treatment they received. And then sometimes, you know, the aggressiveness of policing results in some of the things that we've been catching on video, and we have to work against those. We can't be apathetic. I'm saying we collectively can't be apathetic to include those in the law enforcement communities. You know, I'm seeing some behaviors of them like, oh, here we go again type, and I've been countering them. Let's understand that these things happen. We want to be standing on the right side of this. Like, let's not be deaf behind what people are complaining about, because the conduct is happening and it exists. The way we counter that is to challenge it and say, no, this is not who we are. This is not who we want to become. And so if we were moving in that direction, and that's where I'm trying to participate, I have some people who embrace what I say in the law enforcement communities, and I have some people who challenge me. But I'm going to keep fighting the fight because it's right.
Yeah. Well, we've got these three buckets: fear, ignorance, and prejudice. What do we do? I mean, how do you suggest that is addressed within the police force itself?
Yeah. So you know the fear portion of it could also, I mean, the fear portion is fear, and the ignorance can be handled by one of the ways that we at ACAC really try to walk together in ministry is that's how you overcome fear and ignorance, is by walking together in relationships.
Right.
And so for law enforcement officers, even if they can't in their own personal circles, you know, this isn't an objective on the checklist. Do I have a whatever other than you friend? You know, so if he's black, do I have a white friend? If I'm white, do I have a black friend? I mean, that's as far as I'm saying in the relationship. But don't make that as a sense of duty, like people are people. So you're saying your circles, have I involved my life enough that I am getting perspectives from people that don't look like me? And then that's a relationship. That takes intentionality. People got to choose to do that. And if they don't choose to do it, they'll still be operating from them other two buckets, ignorance and fear. The other thing, too, is, you know, I've been challenged by media. Media has been, I'm saying at large, you know, some people personally take offense, but let's look at some things that happen, how media in Hollywood has portrayed people of color. There's a lot of people making a lot of money off of a whole lot of criminal-type glorification of the criminal element, whether it's gang violence and rap video. I'm not against rap at all. You know me well. But there's some aspects, some people make money off of the hype, all that. Well, that's being projected. I mean, those are things being communicated to people that is the life of some. It ain't the life of all. And so media itself, you know, Faye and I used to say it all the time. It's getting better, but we would listen on the news. It was always, we would watch it specifically, so we just wasn't taking this anecdotal. the news, by and large, when it was a black suspect, they made sure to tell you it was a black suspect. And sometimes they didn't always say that when the person was not black. And we would point that out and say, look, you know, look at the examples here. That might be oversight on their part, but I'm telling you, when you criminalize people's tone of their skin, this is what creates the fear in individuals. And so I think there's a there has been a criminalizing of darker complected people. And I do think some of it comes from, you know, things that we've been massaged into when this is bad. To be dark is bad. And to be white is pure, that we say societally. And Faye brought one up today. It was, you know, we're very careful about what we say. You know, the worst day on on Wall Street, except for we had it close to it in COVID, you know what I mean? So we talk about, you know, Black Monday, you know, and the Black Plague. And, you know, you talk about these things that are just communicating. And I'm really not trying to be facetious when I'm saying this. I'm saying there's some things that just keep, when you look at that, it's denoted as bad. And Faye brought up today, she is like, you know, how we say if you have a green thumb, you know how to plant stuff, but if you have a black thumb, maybe, you know, the stuff that you plant dies. She's like, is that racist? Does it have a racist beginning? I mean, we're being that sensitive to say, what are we continuing in when we say these type of things that create the imagery? So that's it, relationships. The ignorance also is providing opportunities for understanding, even when it doesn't move towards agreement. At least mm-hmm. have opportunities to understand different people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's beautiful to learn of other people's cultures, their upbringing, and stuff like that. And because it's different doesn't make it wrong. You just learn different people. I enjoy learning of other cultures, other people. I think it's a beautiful thing. So that's your relationships and your ignorance. I'll speak to the last bucket. Some of it is there's some people that just don't deserve to be on the job anymore. And so mm-hmm. you got to weed them out. But I do, and I've went to some of our decision makers, our political leaders, and I said this very difficult question to them. I said, where do you give, and I'm going to use public safety law enforcement, I'll use that. What do you give a law enforcement officer if they said, you know what, I think I realize I'm prejudiced. Mm-hmm. If they realize it, I'm realizing I'm prejudiced or I'm biased. Or where do they go? They're going to be, they'll be end up an outcast. I said, so mm-hmm. where is it that gives an opportunity that if somebody really realizes where they have failed, and some, where can they safely go and say, I need to deal with this that doesn't cost them their job? Now, some people would say, well, if they have that, then they should be fired automatically. I said, well, pick a place. Pick some place. You pick any organization. Pick any corporation. Mm-hmm. Don't think everybody there's not somebody in that corporation that doesn't have a prejudice or might be bigoted or might be sexist. Or, you know what I mean? People mm-hmm. have to deal with their flaws. And so don't – when a person's behavior and the course of conduct is repeated and it's been documented, no, I don't mm-hmm. expect them to keep the job. But if somebody identifies, say, well, I've had stinking thinking, I've had wrong, but something's wrong, I'm realizing this was a problem. Where does a law enforcement go that doesn't feel like I'm going to lose my job if I self-identify? Well, mm-hmm. we need to have opportunities for that. And finally, I'll say on that is they try to weed out, you know, the psychological exams and the stuff that we go through. And we have, you know, there's tracking for different types of complaints and stuff. But the best way, and there's some people who might hide it well, but I'll say as a person who has personally witnessed that I know that it happened, and I encourage those that I serve with. They hide it well around me, but when those incidents come up, I challenge them. What did you do about it? You were the one who saw this, you know. And I've had friends that said, you know what, I was with Officer so-and-so, and we were out in patrol, and they used the N-word. I said, so what did you do about that? Mm-hmm. And then you have them have the courage to say, why are you using that? And they have. You know, some people did it. Well, that's the way I was brought up. That's okay. That doesn't make it right. So, I mean, it's mm-hmm. some of that. Some people who are listening may not agree. They feel like that if someone is going to display that, they should be fired automatically. And I just think that, you know, as my statement goes, it's a challenging statement. Don't expect more out of our police department when we're not willing to pursue in our society. Mm-hmm. So if you want your police officer to reflect this high ethical, you know, colorblind, blind to everything and just treat people appropriately, absolutely, I want that as well. But I also expect that out of the citizens in our communities as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that created quite a stir among some of the listeners last time when you made that statement that we can't hold them to a higher standard. We can't expect them to be, you know, our saviors when we walk in so many problems and it's such a low level of morality and ethics. If you're just tuning in, we've been talking to Sheldon Williams, a pastor, entrepreneur, and also somebody who's been a police officer, still very close to law enforcement. I've got to ask you about the defund the police. We didn't have a chance to talk about that last time because it really wasn't an issue. It hadn't come up. Just interested in your general thoughts. I'm sure you've been asked about it before.
I have. You know, it's the same thing like Black Lives Matter. I mean, it's a trigger word for some people. You hear defund the police, just like some people with Black Lives Matter, as soon as they hear that, they think they're, you know, some, you know, marauding anarchist group. And there is a political motive of some people who have attached to Black Lives Matter. But I want to distinguish, you know, make a distinction here between the principle and philosophy of Black Lives Matter and what people are trying to categorize it so that they turn off. That's an easy way to turn the light switch back off when you can sit there and put a negative bend to it. But the philosophy of Black Lives Matter itself is that these lives matter. They have meaning. And so it's not suggesting that these lives are more superior than yours. Mm-hmm. They're just saying that the same focus on these lives have not had the equivalent amount of importance as some other lives. And we're saying they do matter. Like, and so that's the – when people are now embracing that, and I'm hearing some challenge in it because they want to politicize it and demean it, not in its philosophy. And so the same thing with defund the police. Like, it started – there's a portion of defund the police in the movement that wants to see that police departments be disbanded and then some say rebuild and they want reallocation of funding. Now – from the term itself, I understand what they're putting out. The defund the police movement has some criteria that they like to see. What I'm suggesting, defunding the police, anybody who budgets for the appropriate care and equipping of its police department to make sure you have the right amount of officers, that they have the right equipment that, and the stuff that they need to execute their responsibilities and the like, then there's an appropriate budgeting process to make sure that there's allocations for that. If people want to look at policing, modern day policing, and say, can we do policing differently? I think those conversations can be had. Here, there was a time, and we started using it, but there is a time maybe we can bolster this some more. But society has determined, whether it's through the election of political leaders or people who have been pushing agendas, that there's things we've done bad. You know, and we've done badly over years. We used to warehouse the mentally ill on different various scales. We just would warehouse them and put them in institutions and the like. And that wasn't necessarily the right treatment. So there was this push about deregulating. Now, there's two parts to that. There was the one, the human side of it. The other side of it was costing too much. And, you know, and communities, which I'm all for. But I do believe that there's some people who are severely, severely mentally ill, that there's some challenges there. So what I'm saying is what we now have done is dump on the police to deal with them with a mental health issue. And now these individuals who find themselves on the borderline or even delving over, not everybody with mental illness fits this. I'm just saying that there's a flood of people with mental illness now are part of the criminal justice system. They don't need to be incarcerated, they need to be helped, and so it's falling on the laps of police officers we're dealing. You know, same thing with our homeless populations and stuff that we should have more of a social agenda towards caring for these individuals so that they don't have to fall on the laps of police officers. What we're doing in reverse, when we don't handle those well and they're on those borderlines, and everybody doesn't have to be assaultive or whatever to interact with police. They could be on that. How about trespassing? How about defiant trespassing? You know, something as simple as that. At some point in time, that individual's criminal justice system. So now they're down at jail, and you warehouse them in reverse. And our jails are being full of multiple issues, but one of them being some of the homeless and mentally ill and the like, so we're warehousing in reverse. So my point is, there could be some ways of having a better social agenda towards handling those, and there mm-hmm. could be some interaction between law enforcement and those capabilities that we can move towards. But I'm not for defund in the term itself, like allocate the right funding that does mm-hmm. this longstanding handshake to address these issues.
Yeah. Yeah, and politics gets involved, and then you have, shrinking budgets or, you know, limited funds, and it's not an easy process. I thought it was very interesting, you know, in Minneapolis and, where you would defund the police and then hire private security. Well, you know, it's you're just changing the name. You're changing you're paying somebody to do a societal service, and I'm not criticizing them. It's such an intense time, and people are trying to come up with answers, some of them quick answers that, some of it still has to it has to be thought through. And so we've got about mm-hmm. 6 minutes. I want to get to one of the issues you've been asked is what can the church do? How can the church respond? What should the church's position be? I'm not talking about ACAC. I'm talking about the body of Christ in general. Let's just go over that in the last few minutes that we have.
Sure. So, I mean, we, the church, the body of Christ, we have these principles that we embrace and adopt that not only to change our lives, but also that says that we want to be intentional about changing other people's lives. So there's one thing about, you know, when people, the whole salvation and evangelizing people towards salvation for their eternity. Absolutely. But then there's the humanistic dealing with this that we have to deal with, this flawed flesh that we do, and mm-hmm. some people call it discipling and, you know, and the like. But my point is that we can be very intentional. It's great to celebrate when we bring people into the kingdom, but there's the other part that says that how do we live with those individuals who have now came to the kingdom? And so the churches themselves and our good ministry outreach and opportunities and for ministry. I don't want to say anything disparagingly against our efforts towards caring for people. But really, I think it's important for us to really sit back and say, how do we actively participate in making the changes that we want to see in our communities, and then move forward to trying to make those changes. So, something I'm coming back to Fellowship 412 because I'm challenging our folks at Fellowship 412. I told them all to we watched 13th. You know, it's that it was a Netflix documentary. They made it available on YouTube, and I think there's another website. But it talked about the 13th Amendment, the abolishment of slavery, except for when you committed a crime. And then they went through the whole criminal industrial system, how politics and corporation is it's big money, and now it's turning into another way that they're equivocating it to like another form of slavery. Now, some people deserve to go to jail, Dr. John. Some people deserve. But there's a criminalization that's happening at alarming rates. And one of the stats that really shocked me was the United States has 5% of the world's population and 25% of its prison population. That's astounding to me. That's the world's population. We warehouse 25% of the world's prison population occurs within the United States. So what I said to Fellowship 412 was to look at opportunity. We watched 13th. And now after we have discussion around it, what are some ways that we can come in to counteract, to actively participate? And that, I said, not just in ministries, launch of ministries. That's not what I'm looking for. And I'm not calling it, you know, prison ministry, and that's not what we're saying. There's people who are involved in relationship who some people may have found themselves in these situations that we can come and walk with them, and that they then feel like they're part of this family. So I think it's important for us then, as the church at large, is to find those opportunities and not feel obligated to try to check off, do we have this ministry, do we have that ministry, that says that how do we come in to counteract some of the things happening by walking together, taking personal responsibility, not having a church that has this type of ministry going on. We're our personal responsibility to actively participate as God is directing us and leading us so that we can make our own personal change or personal efforts towards change. And if we did that, by and large, if that was being spread throughout the body of Christ, nobody said if every one of us was taking the intentional effort to touch one or two lives, look at how much we would be able to turn around some of the things that are happening.
Yeah, and you know, the issue of leadership is one time my son was 10 or 11, he was on the softball field with us adults when we were practicing, and I thought, oh, he shouldn't be on there, he's too young, and I thought, oh, stop mothering him. Well, 20 minutes later, he slid into second base, and a ball came in and hit him right in the mouth, and so I ended up at the hospital. He needed about 10 stitches on the inside of his lip, and the Lord spoke to me while I was there and said, that's how leadership is. And I said, I don't get where we're going here. Said, if you would have told him to get off the field, that ball would have rolled to the fence, and he would have been mad at you, but he never would have known what he missed. And the thing that the work that you're talking about here is we never know what we've prevented. You know, we see what we could be preventing because when it happens, we say, oh, that's terrible. But God has called, and that's where faith comes in, where you say, well, I can't make a difference. Yes, you can. You know, that person you befriend, that young person you befriend, that person you help go to school, or whatever the expression may be, you just have to trust that you were doing what God wanted you to do and you prevented something that could have been much worse. And I guess it's like what's the Jimmy Stewart movie, It's a Wonderful Life, when he was shown what that community would have been like if he wasn't there. And we have to make ourselves so important that our communities would feel our absence. And I'm not sure we've always done a good job of doing that. Anyway, my friend, our time has run out. I'm always we got 1 minute. Any final word?
No, just I hope people who are listening are encouraged to do something. And as we're saying, pray about it, seek the Lord on it. But, you know, old guy used to tell me, and I use it for more of my entrepreneurial bend, but he says that if you sit around dreaming all day, all you'll get is rest. So it's one thing to sit there and be contemplative and think about, but we got to move to action. We got to make some of these things happen.
Yeah, indeed. And so keep up the good work, Sheldon, and look forward to further reports down the road, and give our love to your family, and we'll be over at the restaurant soon.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. God bless. Bye-bye. All right, Sheldon Williams, a lot of good things, interesting things to say, and that wraps it up for today. Wednesday, I'm going to be back with author Shelley Barad. Shelley is working on her second book, and you got to meet this woman. She's pregnant with her sixth child. She's an author. I mean, the stories she tells in the book, of she's homeschooling. I want to talk to this woman. How is she able to do what it is that she does? So tune in Wednesday or anytime after Wednesday. The interview will be in the archives. Well, this is John Stanko thanking Sheldon Williams for his time, thanking you for your time. Until we're together again, I want to encourage you to be about the work of purpose in your life. So long for now.
Thanks again for listening to Wake Up to Purpose with John Stanko. To get in touch with John, you can go to www.purposequest.com or write him at johnstanko@gmail.com.